And the program of these populist socialists of the SR party, which pretty much attracted all non-Marxist socialists in the country, had two parts. It had a minimum program. This was the first goal to fight for. And this was a democratic and free society in which, to be sure, capitalism existed, but was restricted by various social reform laws, not unlike the liberals were suggesting, though even further than that. In some ways, their minimum program, their immediate program, was also liberal democratic, a liberal democratic society. But they also had a maximum program, what they wanted to achieve in the long term, which would have to wait for a more developed society, more education, more economic development of the country. And this was for a socialist society, which in their mind meant complete control of the economy, though through the state, but also through local institutions, by the classes that worked, by workers and peasants. Unlike Marxists, by the way, who felt workers should, through their party at least, in the Bolshevik case, control society, there was no distinction between workers and peasants in the mind of populists, of socialist revolutionaries. They were all working people, and that's what mattered. They should have some control over their fate, over their lives. There's also, as per tradition, the other side of the SR work, and that was terrorism. They believed, like the earlier populists, that it was necessary to lay the groundwork for popular revolution, to inspire people to prepare to attack the state, and to weaken the government through a series of political assassinations. Whether or not anybody was inspired by terrorism is quite questionable. What is clear is that they effectively terrorized the government. Between 1901 and 1917, the SR party managed to kill 139 officials, many of them quite high, to wound 85 of them, and they only missed 16. And besides these major opposition groups, the liberals and the socialists, the Marxists, the populists, there was also important discontent among certain large social groups. And I need to introduce these sources of these discontent to understand 1905, but in the next couple of lectures we'll talk more about the life of peasants and workers and other ordinary Russians. First of all, peasants were increasingly unhappy, as they in some ways had been since 1861, with the land settlement of emancipation and with their own poverty. It also is worth noting that peasants were increasingly aware of the larger world, more likely to think about alternatives. More on them next time. Even more important, though, given what happened in 1905, where in many ways the revolution started or made its most important step forward due to the actions of urban workers, especially in cities like Petersburg and Moscow, it's important to pay attention, therefore, to the growing discontent, the growing class of urban workers, something relatively new in Russia since the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. Workers in this growing industrial terrain had a lot to be unhappy about. Their material situation in cities like Petersburg and Moscow and others was often horrible, typical of early industrialization. Overcrowded housing, as workers came to the city and nothing adequate was built for them, often with deplorable sanitary conditions. It wasn't unusual to be living in basement apartments in cities like Petersburg, for example, with mold and mildew on the walls and rats crossing their houses, their small rooms. And they were terribly crowded. Long hours at work, a 10 to 12 hour was the normal workday, even after a labor reform in 1897 reduced it from the typical 13, 14, and 15 hour day. Constant risk of injury from unprotected machinery. No laws had yet been passed to protect workers from dangerous wheels and belts. Brutal discipline. It was very much the tradition in Russian factories to list large numbers of strict rules, set very high fines, and just for good measure, a foreman might give you a little bit of a beating to help you learn how to behave. And also terrible diet due to low wages, due to lack of adequate food, but also due to bad habits, such as heavy drinking. But in a certain sense, worker discontent involved more than just getting a better physical life. Workers, too, especially as they were more likely to be literate than peasants, began to be exposed to new ideas in the relatively liberalized press, for example, that they could read, or as was happening more and more through meetings with socialist activists. More and more often, workers were beginning to note the inequalities of city life that was all around them and begin to think about a more just society. And they were encouraged by intellectuals to do this. Probably most worrisome from the government's point of view is that these workers were beginning to act, as I've noted before, to improve their situation. A strike movement began to grow in the 1890s, and it was increasingly responsive to the activities of radicals like Lenin and Martov, who were going among the workers and trying to encourage them. We'll talk more about workers later when I talk about city life, but it's critical to see that this social discontent paralleled these growing demands for democratic change in Russia coming from political parties by intellectuals. Into this increasingly dangerous situation came two potentially explosive elements. First of all, as so often happens in Russian history, when crises break out, another war. This time a war with Japan, begun in early 1904, started formally by Japan, but in really many ways provoked by aggressive Russian policy, trying to compete for property and land and sphere of influence in Korea and in Manchuria, northern China. This war led to a series of really humiliating defeats. And one should add, extra humiliating, not only is defeat in war always a disaster for the Russian monarchy, but defeats by an enemy that had been widely held in public contempt in the Russian press and by Russian officials who regularly spoke of the Japanese as yellow monkeys who would be no problem to defeat. Instead, they suffered some great losses at the hands of the Japanese. The other aspect, the other explosive element into this already dangerous situation was another attempt at reform, partly a response to these visible dangers. And here one often thinks of a comment made quite a bit earlier, about quite a bit earlier period of danger, by Alexis de Tocqueville, a French observer of politics all over the world, but writing in this case about the French Revolution, when he said, "The most dangerous time for a bad government is when it attempts to reform itself." And many have said this is exactly what was happening on the eve of the 1905 revolution. This first attempt by a bad government, as many felt, to reform itself was in fact not the government's doing. In August of 1904, the Minister of Internal Affairs, the most powerful man controlling police and public order in Russia, a man named Vyacheslav von Pleva, was assassinated by socialist revolutionaries, one of the many that they killed. Pleva, many believed, was the most reactionary man in the whole government, and almost universally despised by Russia's educated, especially liberal elites, but even by many of his fellow ministers, who felt that his reactionary approach to public order was in the long run destabilizing. So when Pleva was blown up by a bomb thrown underneath his carriage, even many liberals thought this was a good thing. Even more encouraging to many liberals and even to some of Nicholas's more liberal-minded ministers was the man who replaced him as Minister of the Interior, a prince named Dmitry Sviatopolk-Mirsky. Known for having relatively, in terms of government standards, relatively liberal sentiments. Mirsky immediately initiated what was called a political spring, echoes you can hear here of Loris Melikov's response to a similar dangerous situation at the end of the reign of Alexander II. Political prisoners were released. Harsh police repression against various civic institutions was reduced. And finally, he promised, Sviatopolk-Mirsky promised that in public, that future government policies would, in his words, conform to the spirit of true and broad progress. Many understood this to mean that there would be some sort of democratic, at least consultative, assembly, though nothing so concrete was promised. These initial steps and these promises of reform actually encouraged more protest. People thought, now's the time to really demand what we've been looking for. First among liberals. By this point, liberals were clearly in a bold and fighting mood. In November and December of 1904, they launched a massive campaign to mobilize political opposition and demand real democratic change. They held meetings at zemstvos in the countryside, at city councils, at corporations of the nobility, and at each place a resolution was passed calling for real democratic political reform. The Union of Liberation, which had recently been formed, bringing the liberal movement together, staged a massive banquet campaign, again, in public places all over the great cities of Moscow and Petersburg and even smaller cities. They held banquets, mainly attracting various professionals, liberal professionals. And here, over drinks and dinner, members of educated liberal society would get up and make fervent speeches and pass still more resolutions. What was said at these gatherings was fairly the program already familiar as that of the liberals. Civil liberties, equality of all citizens before the law, more local self-government, and above all, an elected national assembly. And the majority favored a legislative body. Now, in a way, this liberal campaign might have fizzled out or even been crushed, because all these liberals had in mind at this point was passing resolutions, had it not been joined by workers and students in the streets, which was provoked by the ironic nature of history, by the government itself, which on January 9th, 1905, ordered troops to shoot at crowds of workers bringing a petition to the Tsar at the Winter Palace, a moment that became known in history as Bloody Sunday, and truly started what then was not just banquets and demands, but a revolution. The genesis of this particular march is a rather bizarre story, though it has history-making consequences and worth pausing over. Beginning in 1901, the government developed a rather interesting strategy to deal with the growing labor movement. They decided to establish, under the control of the secret political police, which was called at the time the Okhrana, special legal labor organizations. All other unions were illegal. And the purpose was to woo workers away from contacts with political radicals and encourage them to solve their economic problems peacefully, without strikes, and without talking about more radical democratic changes. One of these organizations, established in St. Petersburg in 1904, was headed up and organized by a priest, working also for the secret police, named Georgi Gapon. And his organization, which became known as the Assembly of Russian Factory Workers, was phenomenally successful. Thousands of workers in branches all over the city. At first, they mainly gathered to talk and drink tea, but it made clear that the leaders of this movement cared about their economic conditions. And at a certain point, in December 1904, amidst growing strikes among workers, many of whom were members of the assembly, Gapon decided to organize a major march to the Tsar to express workers' grievances. This march took place on January 9th, 1905, with Gapon leading tens of thousands of workers to the Winter Palace carrying a petition. Now, in a certain sense, this was all a very traditional act. The petition appealed to Tsar, to the Nicholas II, as father of his people, as Tsar Batyushka. And it began with words like this: "We, the workers and inhabitants of St. Petersburg, of various estates, our wives, our children, and our aged, helpless parents, come to thee, O sire, to seek justice and protection. We are impoverished. We are impressed. We are oppressed. We are treated with contempt." They carried pictures of the Tsar. They carried icons. They carried banners borrowed from churches. But the content of what they asked for was in many ways less traditional. They demanded not only that the state intervene to improve working and living conditions, which could be seen as a traditional appeal to Tsarist paternalism, but they also included in their petition a demand for civil liberties, freedom of press, speech, assembly, belief, unions, strikes. Plus, they called for the election of what they called a pre-parliament, a constituent assembly, a body that would create a constitution and that should be based on universal, secret, direct, and equal suffrage, four-tail suffrage. The fate of this is well known. They were met not by the Tsar, who had left town, but by troops with orders to fire on the crowds approaching the palace. Hundreds were injured and killed, maybe as many as 1,000. In the weeks that followed, everything the government had feared came to pass. The number of strikes and strikers in 1905 was greater than all previous years of Russian history combined. The labor movement became more organized than ever before. Trade unions began to appear, paying no attention to the fact that they were illegal. And even new types of workers' organizations, councils of workers' representatives called Soviets, appeared for the first time. Workers' demands also became more political than ever before in response to, in part, the devastating experience of January the 9th. Workers now increasingly said, "We have no Tsar. There's no Tsar, Father, if that's how he can treat us." And they demanded a constitutional republic and full civil liberties. This became commonplace among workers by the end of the year. And to press these various demands, workers' unions began publishing their own newspapers and completely ignoring the censorship laws, in a way showing the government's weakness. People were saying and doing what they want, and the streets were filled throughout the year with endless demonstrations. This was a disaster for the governments, from the government's point of view. The government tried to respond with some mild concessions. Nicholas II, in February, offered a consultative assembly. Years earlier, even a couple of years earlier, this would have been a major achievement. At this point, it was seen as too late, too little. Most people no longer had enough confidence in the government to have a consultative assembly. They wanted a real legislature. And the high point of these protests came in early October in a massive national general strike. For 2 weeks, millions of workers, the vast majority of people earning wages in Russia, stayed off their jobs in factories all over the country, even well out in Siberia, on the railways, in government offices even, in commercial firms, in stores. Every school and university was shut down by its students in October. And meetings open to the public were held everywhere, especially in the halls of universities, with all sorts of classes showing up. And the demands were everywhere the same. In some ways, never had society been so united. Complete civil liberties and a constituent assembly to establish a constitutional order based on a legislature. And for many people, this meant nothing less than a democratic republic. No Tsar at all. In the face of this general political strike, Nicholas was convinced by his ministers that he had to do more. And October 17th, he signed what was called the October Manifesto. This, for the first time in Russian history, formally granted all the basic civil liberties to all Russians and created, amazingly, a Duma, as the legislature was called, with legislative powers, or promised one. In other words, Russia was about to become a constitutional monarchy. Yet many in society were frustrated and wanted still more or didn't trust the government's promises. Many workers and socialists declared the manifesto inadequate and continued to protest. There were even armed, quite violent insurrections in cities like Moscow, especially in December, all put down with force. Students especially continued to not accept these promises, not trust the government, continued to strike until they had proof that these changes were coming about, spending their time not in classes for the rest of the year, but in endless meetings, though gradually, by the end of the year, these faded away. In fact, political strikes became so common that rumors began to spread that not only was everybody striking for politics, that at one point, meant to suggest how exaggerated this became, pregnant women in a hospital, it was said, were on strike and would not have babies until universal suffrage for women was granted. Everybody was on strike for democracy. Soldiers rebelled. Sailors rebelled to transform conditions in the army, and increasingly dangerously, many of the border areas of the empire began to see the first open rebellions. Poland, Finland, where people took to the streets demanding independence and began attacking various symbols of Russian rule. Finally, the October Manifesto began to encourage peasant unrest. Peasants understood the manifesto to say that they were getting freedom. The details weren't all that important to them. What was clear that they got freedom, and they knew what freedom meant. It meant the land. It meant the land was theirs, and they began to seize it, quite convinced that the Tsar had approved it. Meanwhile, many liberals began to find this continuing social movement to be quite frightening. And the split, what had been a truly united country, united for democracy, liberals began to back off from some of their stances. Some liberals, in fact, shared the popular view that the manifesto wasn't good enough. Too little, too late, and in fact to continue the fight for a true legislature that had greater powers than this one they feared would have, they formed the new party, legal in the new political conditions, called the Constitutional Democratic Party, the Cadets, whose job it was to push until true democracy came to Russia. Many liberals, though, more moderate liberals, felt the October Manifesto had done enough. And in fact, the disorder in the country was frightening them, and any further changes would encourage greater social unrest. And to encourage moderation, they established a party, a liberal party known as the Union of October 17th. They were later called the Octoberists. And the name makes it clear what they believed. October 17th, the date the manifesto was granted, is enough. No more. In 1906, within a few months, the details of the promised reforms were announced in terms of a set of laws that became known as the Fundamental Laws. And in many respects, these represented a real, serious effort to include people for the first time in the formulation of policy. Political parties were legalized. Elections to the Duma, the parliament, all Russian men from all classes were to be allowed to participate. And the Duma was given real legislative authority. It could pass laws. But in other respects, this new Duma, the new legislature, proved to be less an effective channel for popular redress of grievances than a constantly frustrating reminder of how the autocracy was not willing to accept true political reform. This was visible in the fact that there were many limitations on the reforms as they were announced in the Fundamental Laws, and even more so in 1907 when many of these rules were changed suddenly. First of all, voting laws to the Duma were skewed in favor of classes the government most trusted, initially landowners and peasants, though in 1907, after dealing with two Dumas, both of which it closed down after just a handful of months, partly due to constant protests on the floor of the Duma, it was decided that the peasant delegates weren't all that conservative after all, and it was changed to favor just landowners. The legislative power of this Duma, which was not elected on equal or universal terms, was also restricted. The Tsar kept for himself the power to veto any piece of legislation that he didn't happen to like. On top of that, so he wouldn't have to always do that, an upper house was created, made out of an existing body, this body of notables known as the State Council, half of whose members under the new law would be appointed by the Tsar personally, the rest well-established notables there by right of position in society, sort of like a House of Lords, but much more appointed. And this State Council was given the power to veto anything the Duma passed that it didn't like, for which it was often known as the gravedigger of democratic legislation in Russia. Finally, just to be sure, as if this weren't enough, the legislative authority of the Duma was limited by Article 87, the notorious Article 87 of the Fundamental Laws, that said the government could at any time it wanted to declare a state of emergency and pass any law it wished while the Duma was out of session, which it would be during a state of emergency. Perhaps even more significant, the Duma's competence as an institution was restricted. A large part of its budget was out of control, had no control over the military or foreign policy, for example. And even more important, day-to-day political power in the Duma, in the Russian government, was in the hands of ministers. Ministers whom the Tsar appointed and who were not responsible to the legislature. The only right the legislature had was what was called interpellation. The right to ask a minister to come and stand before you and explain a policy, and then you would criticize it, and they would go off, and nothing would change except you were more and more annoyed, which was happening increasingly among even the moderate Duma deputies. This isn't to say that the constitutional experiment, as it was called, of 1906 to 1914, when the war came, was a failure. The Duma did, in many ways, offer people a public voice and a measure of public power such had never existed before in Russia. But it didn't satisfy most people. Most of the nation, after all, was unrepresented. In fact, half the seats in the Duma were held by the gentry, who represented 1% of the population. And even those gentry that dominated the Duma through the Octoberist Party, which was, as a result, the largest, were often dissatisfied by the government's refusal to really let them have influence over the government, especially over the ministers. Needless to say, social reforms left peasants and workers dissatisfied, and even workers who were allowed to strike and form unions found themselves constantly harassed and under the supervision of the state. If anything, one might suggest all these half-hearted reforms only whetted people's appetites for more. Next time, I'm going to look more deeply into society, in particular into the lives of peasants and then workers, to understand the social problems we're adding to the mixes of challenge that the government was facing and that fueled desires for change, in particular that fueled the still greater upheaval that was to come that would make 1905 look modest, the 1917 revolution.
Lecture 21, Peasant Life and Culture.
In the next few lectures, we'll be looking rather closely at Russian society and culture during a very critical period, the last years and decades of the old regime, and in particular, that very fateful period between after the 1905 revolution and the coming and beginning of World War I. In many ways, these were very contradictory times. They're times of crisis in Russia, but also times of great possibility, and also for many, many individuals, a time of fateful decision. We know, of course, the outcome of what happens in the course of this period. Once the war comes, anyway, we end up with the violent upheavals of 1917 that bring down the monarchy, and then within a matter of months bring down Russia's liberal democratic government. But by looking more closely, even though we know the results, by looking at the particular lives and experiences of individuals, points of view of different people during these years, I think we can better understand why this event happened. We can also understand from their own point of view how complex these times were. Even though we know the outcome, in many ways they didn't. We can see the roots of the crisis, we can see the roots of the upheaval, but we'll also, by looking closely at this period, be able to understand positive changes, the reasons many people had hope, the reason lives actually for some people improved, which will lead us to understand why some people looked very pessimistically at these years, certain that disaster was coming, and others were filled with optimism of the possibility of creating a new, better society in Russia. It's proper in trying to understand these years and people's lives and expectations and experiences to begin with the largest group in the population before 1917, indeed well into the 20th century, the rural common people, or as they're usually called, Russia's peasants. Now, as we've already noticed, educated Russians, the intelligentsia, professionals, the state, spent a lot of time thinking about and talking about the Russian common folk, or as they were called in Russian, the narod. This is, in fact, a term worth pondering over a moment. It's a heavily laden term for Russians still today. For most educated Russians, including government officials, from the late 18th century into at least the 1940s, to talk about the narod, the common people, was to talk about Russia itself, its nature, its purpose, its character as a nation. In fact, the word narod in Russian means both the people, the common people, and it also means the nation. And when they talked, when educated Russians talked about the narod, or wrote about them, or painted, or sang, the images they created were quite varied. To simplify, one can see two large general images by educated Russians of the common people, and by extension, of the meaning of Russia, especially Russia on the eve of this great crisis. One of these images is what might be called the peasant as an icon, in the sense of an idealized sacred image. For many Russians, peasants embodied all the qualities that made Russia great, that gave it its particular moral and spiritual genius. You remember Tolstoy's image of Platon Karatayev. This is a good early example of this. Many educated Russians continued to see in the common people a deeply rooted sense of social justice, which was seen as characteristically Russian, a strong egalitarianism, and of course the peasant commune being a good example of that. Peasants were said to be closer to nature, and hence Russia to be closer to nature. They spoke of native folk wisdom, of special rationality born of everyday experience, of deep spirituality, of a sort of intuitiveness that made peasants unique and hence made Russia distinctive in the world. Even they talked about peasants' personal beauty, their personal dignity, grown out of nature. There was another image commonly used by educated Russians when thinking about peasants, and that's the image of peasants as dark savages. And indeed, this view became increasingly predominant already by the late 19th century and into the 20th. Many people actually spoke quite literally of peasant savagery, and they used this term. Sometimes they even talked about peasants as like Apaches or as Hottentots, and they used these terms as well. Most often they talked about what they called peasant darkness, the sort of classic word for the absence of enlightenment, for deep, deep backwardness and ignorance. To illustrate this, let me offer just one example, a fairly typical one, from a newspaper article in 1908, written by a temperance activist, concerned with the fact that so many people are drinking so much in Russia. This person writes, and there are many articles like this, "During festivals and holidays, the peasant forgets that he is a Christian. He doesn't go to church, but wanders about the market square from early morning in a drunken stupor, singing rowdy songs, using foul words. Peasants drink themselves into a complete frenzy, bite off one another's fingers, and even thrash each other to death." This was seen as a typical way peasants celebrated holidays. Many accounts about peasant life to be found in newspapers and journals of the day describe a whole range of other typical, it was said, brutalities. Violent battles between youths were often described, where groups of youths from neighboring villages would meet in a field, usually after the harvest, and just beat each other as long as they could bear it until they were all fallen down on the field, leaving many injured and maimed and even dead. Reports often talked about widespread family violence among the peasantry. Husbands who beat their wives, husbands who beat their children, women, mothers who beat their children, everybody who beat the daughters-in-law, the both parents who would beat the daughters-in-law, and on it went. Also, descriptions often were to be found in the press of the brutal punishments that peasants would mete out to those who violated their norms, their rules, their interests. And most particular, this applied to horse thieves, usually people from outside the village who would steal a horse. If they were caught, reports in the paper would often say, they would be sometimes branded with hot irons. They would have their eyes put out. They were beaten in the groin and elsewhere until they died. They had stakes even driven into their throat and chest. And these descriptions were very common and all used as examples of how savage Russian peasants were, side by side with images of their deep spirituality and unique wisdom. I should say that in time, these stories, which became increasingly predominant, of peasant brutality and ignorance would actually be part of the story that many educated Russians would use to explain why the revolutions of 1917 and the violence of the Civil War were so intense, were so violent. Indeed, some Russians still today will explain the whole history of 20th century totalitarianism in Russia as due to the basic ignorance and brutality of the mass of the population. Now, these accounts by educated Russians are part of the picture, parts of the reality for understanding rural Russia. But I want to take you deeper into the world of peasants, especially by the early parts of the 20th century, early 1900s, to try to view peasants from their own point of view, especially the way they thought about the world, their values, their ways of seeing life and coping with life. This is obviously very difficult. Peasants didn't write memoirs. They didn't publish newspapers in their villages. But scholars have been working for the last couple of decades very intensively and finding ways to understand peasant life from their own point of view, beyond the stories educated Russians were telling. And a number of themes emerge from this work. In particular, in many areas of peasant life, it's understood traditional forms, traditional attitudes seem to be strong. Indeed, this is one of the things you expect when you talk about peasants almost anywhere in the world. And we see this especially, this commitment to tradition, in two very important areas that were central to understanding Russian peasant life and values: community and religion. Almost all observers of peasant life emphasize the centrality of the idea of community to the way peasants looked at the world and also how they coped with the world. In all traditional villages, numerous decisions of local life continued to be made, as we have seen before in talking about peasants. These were indeed traditions. These decisions continued to be made by an assembly of the heads of household, of the commune, usually a single village, sometimes a couple of villages, the commune, which we've talked about before, called the Mir or the Opshina. Many important decisions continued to be made by the assembly of heads of households of this commune. And this communal assembly and its elected officials continued to collect and pay taxes. They would care for needy members of the community, making decisions about where welfare would go. They would deal with outsiders, which the village had to deal with, rather than let individuals deal with them. With local officials, the commune usually paid their bribes. With landlords, with schools, and the like. They decided in questions of internal law and justice. This is very important, of course, after emancipation, when the landlord's role as adjudicating problems in the village was no longer present. The commune now became the law, agency of law and order in the village. And, of course, very importantly, as long before emancipation, the commune was in charge of deciding things about local land use. What work would be done in every field? When things would be planted, when they would be harvested, what you would grow, how you would fertilize. And it's worth remembering, peasants did not have private enclosed farms. Peasants owned or worked, until they were redistributed, strips of land spread through various large communal fields. And they had to work those strips in the same way as their neighbors working that field. The commune decided how work would be done. It also decided, as you know, to periodically redistribute those strips to make sure every family had enough to feed itself and every family had the right amount for the number of working hands they had. In all things, even beyond this, the village was a community. The commune was, in a way, representative of a whole set of values. Everything about the structures and activities of peasant life suggests that community wasn't just a fact, wasn't just a structure. It was indeed a central cultural value for peasants. This can be seen, for example, most vividly in how peasants enforced community moral norms, how they enforced social order, about law and justice in the village. I'll give you an example. In a province, Novgorod province, it happens, in the northern parts of Russia, a woman named Drosida Anisimova, just an ordinary peasant woman, was caught by a village policeman, who were hired to make sure everything was done according to the rules of the commune, was caught picking berries way out on the edge of the village before the time that the commune had said it was berry picking time. It wouldn't be fair if some individual went out and picked berries. She wanted to. She was grabbed. She was dragged into the village. A meeting of the assembly, the heads of household were called. Indeed, everybody often showed up at these sort of meetings, women and children. And the meeting of the assembly decided what her punishment should be, which was not arbitrary. It was completely in accord with custom. No one was surprised. They stripped her naked. They took that basket of berries she had collected and hung it around her neck. And then they paraded her up and down through the village street, accompanied by the entire community, which was banging on wash tubs and frying pans and ringing bells and shouting and humiliating her as best as they possibly could. Similar forms of peasant justice, sometimes called by historians rough music, were meted out to other types of offenders against the rules of the community. Women, for example, discovered on marriage not to be virgins. This was considered a communal issue, and women should be publicly shamed if this was discovered. Adulteresses were similarly publicly shamed, sometimes male adulterers, but less often. There was definitely a double standard. Petty thieves. Not serious theft, not like horse thieves. We've talked about what was likely to happen to them, which was at the very least that they would be beaten to death. There was no tolerance for horse thieves. But if a peasant was caught stealing a rake from the front of another peasant's house or stealing an item of clothes hanging on a line, they would similarly be shamed in this public procession through the village. The point of all this should seem clear of this ritual. These were public ritual humiliations. This was what they were intended to do. And the purpose was clear, to remind individuals that they were less important than the community, that the community and its order and its moral norms had to come first. And this value of the community had a lot to do with how peasants understood what it was necessary to do to survive in a harsh world. It was a moral value, community, mores. It was also a pragmatic value. This order was needed, peasants felt, to survive in the very harsh conditions of their life, also to avoid conflict within the community. Now, a second area that is absolutely key to understanding peasants' view of the world is religion. It tells us a lot about the worldview of peasants. In particular, peasants continue to see religion, and one might even say to use religion, as a means for understanding and coping with a harsh world, for making this world meaningful and making it livable. Now, Russian peasants were on the whole Christians. They were all Christians. Most of them were Eastern Orthodox, though many were old believers and some belonged to various schismatic sects. However, even if one looks only at Orthodox peasants, the vast majority, one sees that their orthodoxy had its own particular characteristics, its own forms and emphases and adaptations, telling us a lot about how peasants related to the world. First, a generalization. Peasants looked at the world as a place filled with powerful but invisible spirits and forces, good, evil, a little bit uncertain, vague forces like God himself, like the saints, Christ, but fate, something more vague but nonetheless important to peasants, but also very specific, concrete and often quite old ideas of spirits that inhabited the world. Devils, not just the devil, but varieties of little devils, sprites of all sorts who were believed by peasants to inhabit and haunt their house. There were house sprites, forest sprites, river sprites, devils that were likely to be roaming about certain streets, devils who lived in your well. The world was inhabited with forces. But just as important, peasants saw this world not as one, though it was invisible, not one of unfathomable mystery, not one filled with uncontrollable powers. Peasants believed they had the means, never perfect, but always approximate, always effective to some degree, to have some power over all of these powerful forces. And religion is what gave peasants this power. Icons, for example, were central to the life of every Orthodox peasant. Every peasant house would have one or more icons, usually always hanging in a corner of the main room, with candles or lamps burning in front of them. The nearby church, if the village was lucky to have one nearby, or a chapel if it was smaller, was filled with icons in all places of the church, which peasants would bow down before. They would kiss the icon. They would light candles in front of them. There were special stands for this purpose. They would recite special prayers asking for help and care. In fact, certain icons were especially venerated by peasants. Most of all, these were icons of the Mother of God, of the Virgin Mary. The Russians always emphasized her motherhood, her caring role, rather than her virginity. Many saints were often venerated. Western saints like Saint Nicholas, but also many medieval Russian saints who were venerated in Russia. Christ was prayed to, though far less often than his mother, and God the Father was almost never addressed. He was seen as too far, too distant, and besides, it was not allowed by Russian tradition to portray God the Father on any visual image. He was generally seen as somebody that Mary or Christ would talk to for you. Most important, it was believed that a particular icon, certain revered icons, had special miraculous powers. They could cure the sick. They could answer prayers for help. They could rid your house or your fields of an unclean spirit, as peasants tended to call these various evil forces. And it should be noted that the icon itself was not seen as powerful. That would have been, peasants would have known, idolatry. Peasants understood that icons were nothing but paint on wood. But they believed, thanks to the grace of Mary or Christ or a saint, that icons were capable of acquiring a presence, the presence of Christ or Mary or a saint, who could then hear one's prayers and offer help. And, of course, the power of icons to cope with this powerful world of multiple forces, the power to heal and cure and help, was supplemented by other religious aids, holy water, often to be found in sacred wells where peasants would go on pilgrimage to, prayer, many very well established by the church, but also things that had older origins, magic rites, incantations, potions, herbs from the forest. All these things were seen as part of the religious power peasants had to cope with the world. They turned to holy persons for help, priests, monks, wandering holy men, but also to less official healers, sorcerers, magic healers, people whose origins as sacred individuals went back even before Christianity came to Russia. In other words, religion gave peasants power to make sense of the world and to cope with it. And of course, religion meant both Christianity and older mystical and magical traditions that critics tended to call Russian paganism. But it was all for a peasant combined in a rich syncretic mixture. To give you a typical example of this mixture of traditions, when an epidemic hit a village in certain parts of Russia, according to tradition, village maidens would harness themselves to a plow on the edge of town. Sometimes in some villages the tradition was that they would be stripped naked. This would be, of course, at night. They would then plow three furrows around the entire village. And for good measure, they would be carrying icons while they engaged in this rite that many people considered quite pagan. All of this was part of peasants' power to understand and cope with the world, and quite different from the way educated Russians tended to understand life. Now, in many respects, as observers have noted, as I've been describing, peasant life was observed, was imbued with tradition, though critics tended to call this backwardness and superstition and ignorance. Deep religiosity, deep attachment to traditional ways of doing things, including against the advice of agronomists who said this isn't the best way to grow crops. Tradition mattered. And of course, as we've seen before, loyalty to the Tsar, belief of the Tsar as father protector. This didn't, however, make peasants passive and content. On the contrary, in the wake of emancipation and well into the 20th century, there's a great deal of discontent and anger in peasant life. Above all, peasants were increasingly preoccupied with the need for, you've heard it before and you'll hear it again, more land. Many observers, in fact, began by the late 19th century to talk of a desperate land hunger among peasants. And many said this was, in fact, the dominant fact of peasant life and thinking in the early part of the 20th century, until 1917, when this dream was actually realized. There are a number of reasons for this land hunger that tell us something important about peasant life. First was the obvious fact, as I've mentioned before, that peasants got only part of the land that they had formerly worked. Some of the very best lands remained in the hands of the former serf owners, or individuals who bought the lands up from failing serf owners, which was a phenomenon throughout this period. And peasants found themselves working for wages on lands that sometimes they often had, and they were remembering this well into the 20th century, that they had before emancipation. Even though they didn't own it, it was their land to work. Now they only had to receive wages to be able to work this land. Secondly, another reason of peasants felt the sense of land shortage was an enormous growth of population, suggesting something about actual improving economic conditions in the countryside. Every family, as these years went on, ended up with less and less land. In fact, from 1877 to 1905, there was a 20% drop in how much land each family on average had. Interestingly enough, in these same years, and continuing after 1905, peasants as a whole held more land in Russia. Many landlords simply couldn't afford to maintain their own estates and sold it off to richer peasants. But there were more and more families due to rising population, and as a result, each family had less and less land. Third problem was low productivity. After all, how much land is enough depends on how productive your land is. And there's a number of reasons for this low productivity. Partly, simply, nature. Poor soil in many areas, short growing seasons because of the northerly areas of most of Russia. Also to blame was the technical backwardness of the peasant economy. Most peasants still work with very primitive tools, light plows that very shallowly dug into the earth, not the heavy plows you'd find in Western Europe. Many peasants had no draft animals to even pull these plows. And indeed, one of the most poignant and telling images of how backward Russia's rural economy was were images of an old man, perhaps, together with his son, yoked to with the harness to the plow, pulling it through the fields. Also to blame was what many peasants, many observers of peasant life said were peasants' own errors, their own ignorance, which produced low productivity. Many observers, economists at the time and still, argued that communal agriculture was simply not useful for being creating a productive system on the land. First of all, since your land, due to the redistribution, might belong to someone else, what interest did you possibly have to improve it? You had no incentive. After all, your land would be yours, and 20 years later it would be somebody else's, maybe 10 years later. So why would you adopt modern techniques on your little plot of fertilization or deep plowing or crop diversification, even if you wanted to or knew these things? Equally important, the commune always said the best guide to everything is custom. And much of the scientific advice given to peasants was ignored because peasants would say, my grandfather did it this way, and my great-grandfather did it this way, and I will do it this way, even if they remain desperately poor. Of course, the division of land into tiny strips, part of communal agriculture, was also seen by many economists at the time as one of the reasons land was so unproductive. It wasted land. Between every strip, there had to be a little barrier of land. It wasted time. You didn't just work your field, you worked your strip, and then you had to grab your plow and maybe your horse if you were lucky and go over to another field and work that strip. And of course, it compelled conformity. But finally, and if you asked a peasant, this would have been what they would argue, not any of these other issues, why they needed more land. Most importantly, I think, from peasants' own point of view, they hungered for more land, indeed, one should say, for all the land, because, like peasants everywhere, they believed it was their moral right to have all the land. The land should belong to those who work it, and they, of course, worked it all. It was their sweat and their labor and, therefore, their right to have the land. Of course, it's worth saying nothing is inevitable. Had economic conditions for the peasants improved, it's possible that this dream of having all the land rooted in this moral notion might have faded. It did indeed for peasants in other countries throughout the world. But economic conditions, real poverty, for most peasants, and also rising expectations due to the expanding economy that put more goods on the market, reinforced this age-old desire. In other words, poverty, and one might add possibilities, kept alive values that encouraged peasants to dream of radical change, of getting all the land. Now, from what I've said, it might seem that peasants were living largely in a world of their own, a world apart, a world deeply entrenched with traditional values and beliefs. This was true, but not entirely. In fact, village life by the late 1800s already was entwined with changes affecting Russia as a whole. Indeed, the second half of the 19th century and into the 20th century was a time for peasants of dramatic social and cultural change, especially cultural change. Schools were proliferating in the villages, and a growing number of peasant youths, especially peasant boys, had the opportunity to attend at least a couple of years of a rural primary school. Literacy was rising, learned at home, but also learned at school. In fact, before emancipation, almost no peasants could read and write. By 1897 already, 40% of young peasant males, males under the age of 29, were already literate, and these numbers were growing. Paralleling this was a massive increase in publications directed at lower-class Russians. Cheap newspapers began to appear in the village that could be read, but also read out loud by those who could read. Illustrated magazines began to proliferate in these years. And these texts told stories about the larger world, peasants began to know what was going on in their own country, in Europe, in America, in Africa, and elsewhere. There were reports about the curiosities of everyday life, murders in their own country and elsewhere, circuses, wrestlers, but also sorry stories, sad stories about how hard the life of homeless children were in the city, or stories about new religious cults, or accounts with pictures of skyscrapers going up in New York and Chicago, or accounts of air flight in the world, and a lot else that awakened their imagination to the world. There were also books aimed at common readers, ranging from science to adventure stories. And here, too, peasants would read about individuals asserting themselves, exploring the world, things that could awaken their imagination. Most important, many peasants, especially young men, were going off to work in the growing cities, here where they acquired new tastes, which they often brought back to the village, and indeed where they began to acquire material goods, which they brought back with them and showed off to their peasant families, factory-made clothing and new urban styles. They might get their hair cut not under a bowl, but in what Russians called the Polish style, cut more narrowly and combed on from the side. Women were beginning to buy jewelry and makeup. Wristwatches were beginning to show up, all of which began to make peasants think about changes in their lives. Still, in the face of all this, most peasants remained dirt poor. They might have known about greater possibilities, but this didn't make their lives more happy. Indeed, it may have made many of them desire more and hence feel their poverty more intensely. Let me conclude with a final observation. As I think you could see, peasants' world, the world of peasants as they approach the age of revolution and war and the age in which the Soviets would try to remake the whole world of the peasants, was a complex world. It included intense belief in community, but also individual assertiveness. After all, there were those peasants who violated norms, who picked berries too early, who went off to the city, who read books and magazines and newspapers. It was a place of strong moral values, but also of great brutality. The stories I told at the beginning were not untrue. They were part of the whole picture. It was a world filled with awe before magical power, but also a sense of peasants' own power to cope with this world, to change it. It was a world in which peasants believed in the pervasiveness of suffering, accepted suffering like Christ had suffered, and dreamt of change. Next time, we move on this complicated story to the growing cities where the situation was no less contradictory, no less filled with crisis and possibility.
Lecture 22, The Modern City and Its Discontents.
If, as we've seen last time, rural Russia, life of peasants, was changing in dramatic ways and also in many ways deeply traditional still in the early part of the 20th century, latter part of the 19th century, it was in the city during these years that we see the most dramatic evidence of a really different Russia in many ways emerging, different economically, different socially, different culturally, and that's the subject of this lecture. In thinking about what's happening in Russia's cities, it's actually useful if we return to an idea I mentioned some time ago, the notion of a public sphere, something emerging really since the late 18th century. Now, in the classic definition of this public sphere, this is a social space that exists in any society, or doesn't exist in many societies, at least very extensively. A sphere that exists between private life, between family life, and the life of the state, the formally political life. In other words, it's the civic sphere between the individual and the state. It's organized. It has various institutions where people can come together. And very importantly, people can participate in this public civic life without repression, without coercion. They're free to come together and gather. And in this space is where public opinions, where citizens' ideas about the